everybody, and welcome to Monetization in Sport, a new sports business podcast. And who better to do it with than my good friend, Alan. Alan, welcome to the show. Well, this is actually your show in theory. You started this way back when, and we've decided to kick this back up. But Alan, for those listening for the first time who don't know you, let's talk a little bit about you.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure. I'm hanging out with you. I figured we always have this interesting conversations about sports business, so why not actually bring it to everybody else? Actually, I did start it, yes. It was a tryout. I started it exactly a year ago, actually. During Corona lockdown.
To the date, exactly a year.
I think it should be pretty close, yes. Should be pretty close. I was in lockdown. I had just come to Germany by the time. I had a lockdown with an Indian peer, and he was a programmer working for a big company here in Germany. So, you know, I told him all about it. He was a big esports guy, so we just went at it and dived in pretty much on how to get an esports. What are the hurdles? What's everyone looking at? What's the big buzz around it? So, yeah, it was a year ago, and then now with you, I hope we can deliver some noise out there and see what the big fuzz and buzz is all about sports and business.
Well, definitely. There's so many shows out there about, you know, the games and the tactics and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But there's not many shows out there with like the behind the scenes stuff, which some people find boring, but I'm sure people who are listening, and you and I, we don't find that boring. That's interesting to us. So hopefully there are some interested listeners as well.
Yeah. Well, look, you've asked me to make a short intro about myself. Not going to make a long one, pretty much. I'm an industrial engineer, Michael. I worked in a telco for almost 10 years, 8 years to be exact. And telcos are fast, you know. Stuff comes and goes really quick, and competitors are very aggressive. And in telco, everything changes, you know, from strategies, from products, from technology. So I was there in the early 2000s when things weren't as they are today when it comes to digital footprint. You know, there's a huge scale now. But back then, we were reaching a point where minutes or voice was reaching a limit. So then we had to go into, well, how do we grow ARPU? You know, how do we reduce churn? How do we keep this? And that transition was happening back then when everything was really transitioning into digital, you know. Everybody was putting out their packages and services and add-ons, and the value was there. And now data, of course, takes more than 70% of revenue when it comes to telco. So I was there as an early transformer, so to say. So the whole thing bend in now. I know a lot of people throw around digital transformation, but back then it was more of an analog, so to say. So that's pretty much my background, you know, after telco, which I hold a master's in telco, so I'm sort of qualified to speak, let's say, a bit about it. Then I went to Lausanne, and then the Olympic capital of the world. The AASTS is one of the best programs out there in sports management and technology. So I went there, and I had a residency in Lausanne in Switzerland from 2014 and part of 2015, which was great. You know, we had access to everything, pretty much the core of it all. Did you know 80% almost of Olympic governing bodies are seated there in Lausanne?
There's a fun stat for everyone playing at home. That's a great stat.
Yeah, it's there. Actually, a lot of them are in one building. It's called Maison de Sport, the House of Sport. A lot of them are there, you know. So Lausanne, you could actually think of it as a small Wall Street sports. You know, it's a lot of the decisions are being based there. What happened was the Olympic Committee, of course, being seated there, gave access to all these thriving federations who wanted to be close to the action and get a hand or a say in a game. So they all started building around there. So that's pretty much my story with sports management. I was handling key accounts for my former telco and their involvement with sports. So that's when I started seeing the opportunities in sports. Pretty much on the brand side and the corporate side, all these brands would come and say, oh yeah, please help me, please support me. I'm like, why are they saying that? they have a big platform, you know, they have venue, they have stadiums, they have fans. Why would this entity come and tell me to support them? I should be the one that actually wants to partner with them. So this is where I started going deeper into understanding how this model works, this ecosystem. Eventually became a passion. Eventually I just went crazy, quit my job and went to Lausanne to study this. And this is what I do for a living now. So thank you for hosting this space, which hopefully will allow us to talk about behind the scenes of sports, because there's the 1%, there's Bundesliga, UEFA Champions League, and the sexy part of it. But the
fun stuff.
there's a whole world around it. I mean, you know, you work in sports as well, Michael. You're working with the A-League. I work with lots of South American sides, with merging talents. So there's a whole opportunity in uncharted territory out there. So this is pretty much what I think we can uncover and explore and let everybody out there what the real scene in sports is all about. So that's just about me. And well, 100%. You know, maybe you could tell us a bit about yourself as well.
Oh, definitely. So as you said, I work in sport. I do a lot of things within the sports space. My background's startups, actually. So conventional startups, conventional businesses, effectively putting go-to-market strategies for overall services. And that also includes the digital transformation side of it. So things like, you know, how do we correctly monetize for that business? But my passion for sport changed that, and that brought me more into the broadcast space, particularly emerging broadcasters in different markets, working with different leagues, right groups, you know, competitions around the world, where effectively you're trying to help them grow and create that platform, that business platform, or that marketing platform, which ultimately leads to that. And that's something that, you know, you and I connected on in the first instance, was where we realized that there's such a disconnect, where these emerging markets have so much potential and they have so much potential growth, and they're not fully utilizing their asset base or their property base that they possibly could. And, you know, it's a world of opportunity. You know, I see this with in the world of broadcasting, where I'm doing work at the moment, and you look at some of these leagues and you sort of go, why are you not doing this, or why are you not trying this out, or how have you not thought of it? And it's access, and you know, people often think that these things are so far out of their reach, where, oh, they've got it in the Premier League. Well, of course they do. It's the Premier League. Or they've got it at the Olympics. Well, of course it's the Olympics. But the whole new world, and you mentioned the digital transformation and this digital age, all that stuff's now available to even the smallest of leagues and the smallest of broadcasters. And there's this huge opportunity out there. And, you know, I found in my time working with sport groups is that for them, it often comes down to manpower, but often just the expertise and know-how. And between you and I, we often sort of fill that gap. And I guess a huge part of starting or restarting this show is to talk about, you know, everything from top to bottom. So your big name sports business issues, all the way down to your lower end, your entry level, your emerging markets, your youth markets, all that kind of stuff, you know, top to bottom. Because these lessons that we learn from the big strategies can be applied. And, you know, for us, this is what we do day to day these days. And, you know, we're hoping that those listening will be able to get something out of it, learn something, maybe even debate with us, tell us what you think we're wrong about. You know, it's an open debate sport. Doesn't matter what it's about, whether it's a game, an offside decision, some sort of foul, or whether it's about sports business, everyone has an opinion and everyone's entitled to it. So let's jump in to one of the topics we're going to be talking about. And we mentioned top end, I guess the top end of world sport in terms of commercialization these days is the Formula One. Now, Alan, I know you're not a massive Formula One fan. I know you know about it. And I think it's important to note that while you don't have to actually be a fan of a certain sport to understand the commercialization of it, I think that's important for many people. But, you know, I'm an F1 fan personally. One of the big things that happened in the off-season was obviously the driver shift. And AlphaTauri, one of the Formula One teams, actually linked to Red Bull. They signed Tsunoda, one of the Formula 2 drivers, who is Japanese, and he's the first Japanese driver in F1 since 2014. And obviously he'll start this season, which starts in Bahrain later this month at the time of recording. DAZN have signed up Tsunoda and Scuderia AlphaTauri in a commercial deal, which is quite interesting. Obviously it makes a lot of sense to sign you know, the two as they push into the Japanese market. But we thought we'd sort of talk about that Asian push into that market and taking advantage of the opportunity that was there for both AlphaTauri and DAZN. So, Alan, from your side, you know, you've played in emerging markets, you've played in markets where you've had to introduce, whether it be a team or a concept, or introduce a new idea. AlphaTauri are an Italian side. You know, there's, apart from probably a few fans, there's probably not a heavy Asian following specifically for AlphaTauri, as they're not one of the highest fancied sides. But DAZN have seen this as an opportunity. What's your take on that strategy for them?
Great. Well, it's pretty interesting. I think I can identify completely with this kind of strategy. And I'm going to give you actually a quick round of fire. But before I jump into that, I did have a glimpse at Tsunoda actually lapping an Imola in their new ATO2 vehicle. So, and I've seen the team principal Toast speak about mentioning only a few races are probably necessary for him to start getting some F1 points, which is pretty interesting because there has to be a balance between a market strategy penetration and which is why you bring an Asian driver into the side, and actually their performance, you know, on and off the track, specifically here on the track. So a quick round of fire for you, actually, Michael. You're a GM in a broadcasting OTC. You know, the DAZN has a similar performance, so to say, a similar industry. Does your club, league, or broadcast have a market penetration strategy? Do you, Michael, for example, who run actually a broadcasting company, do you have a market penetration strategy? That's the first thing we need to look around here, because the Italian side was pretty, you know, Formula One, they have a huge reach and they have a model that works. A model that probably works for Formula One itself. I remember one of my professors in the ASCS from Formula One actually telling me, actually, you could read it on the Bernie Ecclestone book. All these franchises that acquire the F1, they don't make profit off it. It's just, They've asked Bernie Ecclestone, and why do you think people just want the franchise so bad if nobody makes a profit of it? And Bernie Ecclestone said, because everybody believes that they can make it better. Everybody believes that they could really, you know, improve it, that this time it'll work. So it's so, you know, Formula One is so prestigious. It's so glamorous. It's an attractive, I mean, the brand itself, it's so, you know, up there that you want to, but actually it's not a profitable thing. But
do you know what's funny about you mentioning that? Is that when you look at that's something that's always interests me as a Formula One fan, is you look at some of the teams and you're like, well, okay, I can understand the loss leader there, because Mercedes, if they do well, they'll probably sell more cars, even though there's a school of thought that they actually don't. They tend to sell more cars when they're not doing well. And Ferrari is the same, although that's interesting as well, because that's top end. You know, someone who's got 300,000 in disposable income isn't going to buy a Ferrari because he saw Charles Leclerc win a Formula One race in it specifically. But it's like that prestige thing, just like you say. But Red Bull was an interesting one. And obviously Red Bull own AlphaTauri. And I find it very interesting with Red Bull's strategy, because they're not selling cars, they're selling energy drinks. So it's an interesting
lifestyle,
one.
Actually.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's this, it's a huge, very expensive brand awareness exercise.
Yeah, so, but going back, I mean, this is the first thing that we should ask ourselves, and maybe, you know, set back and say, well, do I even have a market strategy for my own website, you know, for my own analytics, for my own business? But it should be scaled the same. And you mentioned earlier that a lot of these tools are available now. I mean, there's really no setback if you're a small club or a small league or small broadcaster for you not to be implementing a lot of these solutions that are being replicated by the big players. I mean, pretty much, as you said, the limitation here is the know-how and the access. So I'm going to leave you with this, and this is for, you know, a good exercise. Does your club, league, or broadcaster have a market penetration strategy? If you're not maximizing all your resources, then you're probably leaving money on the table. And this is as good as it gets. And let me tell you what I can relate this exercise to. I don't know if you're familiar with Eibar, which is a La Liga club.
Yes.
Eibar is in the Basque country in Spain. It only has 27,000 people. Now, that's pretty small. I mean, this you know, in big country, that's a village. No offense, of course. I'm sure it's beautiful, but it is a very small club. And this club has to compete with that population, with the resources it has, that city, with all the bigger clubs like Madrid and Barcelona. Now, you can imagine the differences, you know. Eibar is mostly, they make arms since medieval times. So they are heavily relying on metal and steel industries. So you can relate to that ecosystem competing in La Liga. Now, their strategy was pretty interesting. What they did was they brought a Japanese and they opened that Japanese avenue and they never let it go ever since. Now, if you look today at Eibar, they are signing Yoshinori Muto from Newcastle. They got Takashi Inui from Frankfurt. He was actually here in the Bundesliga. It's the first time in a Liga two players from Japan are in the lineup. You know, I mean, I remember Japanese players coming along to Europe. I mean, I remember Hidetoshi Nakata back in the late 90s and early Nakamura 2000s.
At Celtic.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was great. I mean, I even had a Nakata shirt, I remember, for the Japan World Cup, and he used to play in the Perugia side and Roma. I think he was in Fiorentina as well. I mean, memory could be around there. But going back, I mean, Eibar, you can actually see this in Six Dreams, a great documentary that shows behind the scenes. I don't know if you're familiar with Six Dreams. It's an Amazon Prime. You can watch it. The beauty of Six Dreams is that it shows a struggling player who's on his way out, and he's a Mexican player, and how he's performing in a, you know, mid-level table club. And then it has a lot of beautiful behind-the-scenes footage. And you can see, for example, when they get someone like Real Madrid playing in Eibar, you really see the venue. You really see the stadium. The stadium has wood, and it looks really like your local stadium. It's amazing because you get to see the huge difference. But how does a club like that get to compete? This is a market penetration strategy. At some point, and you can even confirm it if you actually watch the whole Six Dreams, which I believe it's on season 2 or season 3 now, you can actually see that 50% of their commercial revenue at some point came from Japan. Or their media strategy was up to 50% coming from Japan just because they had this Japanese player. Now, imagine this. I mean, this is something small, emerging leagues, clubs could deal with if they had a market penetration strategy. Now, they have a market strategy, you know, just like Formula One is trying to do a market strategy, or the Zone, you know, they are trying to do this link with their Japanese driver who's actually performing really well. I know he had third place in F2, so I believe it's a few laps that will get him out there. But I mean, there's no excuse actually for anyone not to have a market strategy. Look, you have, how do you get this done? Through access to analytics, predefined strategy, clear objectives. Now, if I might say, but you probably know this better, Michael, what's probably DAZN looking at? I mean, let's set the KPIs for DAZN. What do you think is going to make this worth for DAZN? I'm thinking views, reach, subscribers, engagement markers. I mean, they're probably looking at the specific numbers of views in that domestic territory, you know, probably increase their fan base or reach any demographics or customers, probably increase their engagement markers in social media from a certain number. But this is something that's completely measurable, quantifiable, and should hit a ROI target. And this is the way all the big clubs and leagues are doing it. You know, they have a predefined market strategy and then they expand to it, of course, set with KPIs, set with numbers. Now, what's stopping you, for example, or any club down there in tier 2, tier 3 from doing something like this? It's a really good exercise to think, you know, this is something completely out of reach, from your local baseball league to your big F1 deal with DAZN. So this is how I could relate to it, and I think this is what DAZN is trying to do, of course. I mean, I understand the model, and pretty excited to see what works out of this.
I think one thing that's really interesting is that, and a lot of brands don't take this into account, it's the idea of this brand affinity as well. Obviously, the zone's quite established in a lot of Asian markets at the moment. But what this does is, for those who are quite, aligned with Formula One, you know, if you're a Japanese Formula One fan and then, you know, you're keeping tabs on the news and you see that Tsunoda is going up from F2 to F1, you're quite proud, you know, in the same way that I'm proud of Danny Ricciardo for killing it and Oscar Piastri in the future, you know, big fans of those guys because they're Australian. So for me, my team this year is McLaren because Ricciardo is at McLaren. I have no affinity to other teams. It's just the driver. F1's quite rare in that because it's a lot of the time it's quite driver-based. People follow certain drivers. They don't follow certain teams specifically, but they'll follow the team that their driver is driving for. And in this instance, Tsunoda, much like in the Australian market, Tsunoda's the one Japanese driver in the field. And for DAZN, this allows a bit of brand affinity with that affinity that goes towards Tsunoda. People are going to polarize around him. Japanese F1 fans are going to be interested in following him. And for them to align, and I believe they're, one of the things they're offering is an exclusive annual subscription to DAZN for these Japanese customers. And you pay these packs and you get like super fan special access competitions and like virtual or in-person meet and greets. Obviously, I think things like COVID might make that a bit tricky. But these, you know, virtual things and these abilities to get that access to that extra content, from a broadcasting perspective, it's almost a bit of a no-brainer because for the end user, for the customer, they're looking at that going, wow, that's amazing. I'm getting really good value out of that. But in reality, it's not that much extra work for DAZN to actually deliver that. And for them, that increases their return on investment because people who are heavily invested in the driver are going to sign up for that. They're going to pay presumably the extra high pass to get access to that. They get all these extra freebies. And for DAZN, it's just a couple of extra bits and pieces of content they're shooting week to week. So the value is there for them. And the biggest thing for that is polarizing with that. And I think you can look at things like Liverpool as an example, or Manchester United, those big football clubs, when they do their strategies in Asia as well, because for them, there's this immediate and huge brand affinity. And they've monetized that by creating things like Manchester United TV and Liverpool TV and selling them to domestic broadcasters. And they're able to get extra money from that. Because there's an affinity already that exists and they're just taking advantage of that. It's slightly different to this DAZN deal, but it's similar. It's playing on the affinity people have with that brand or that person, in this case, person. One thing that I find extremely interesting about this whole thing is this strategy doesn't work for a linear TV, you know, provider. This wouldn't work for a cable TV provider. You touched on it yourself, Alan, there when you talked about the analytics and everything obviously comes back to that digital and information age. This is all possible only because DAZN are an OTT platform. If I said this wasn't DAZN, it was probably, say it was a state-owned Japanese network and they were creating this strategy, much harder for them to actually firstly measure their success, measure their strategy, understand their market, because they don't get the detailed analytics that we do in OTT world. And, you know, you and I talk about data all the time, and sometimes it's quite hard to get when you've got certain complications in certain markets. But the data is what makes this strategy work.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think you've touched the magic bullet here. Pretty much there's I think the essence of this, the essence of the DAZN deal, is that they're giving specific content, you know, exclusive content away. Now, content, it could be generated in many forms. And I think content generation is something completely at reach for, you know, for every kind of sports organization, you know, from tier one to tier three. What DAZN is, of course, offering is a highly polished product, you know, which with a lot of add-ons, but it comes down to them capitalizing over their content, you know, which is a good market strategy combined with content strategy. Pretty much it has to do with all the resources you have there. Now, the question I would probably challenge everyone to is, what is everyone doing with their content? You know, in this case, the DAZN has access to a lot of content. They're paying for a specific amount of money or compensation deal to get access to specific places or scenes, and actually they're capping over on content. So the other interesting asset you're talking about is OTT. And OTT, I think, is a big disruptor in the industry. We've seen how slowly some organizations, but usually the big ones, are emerging with OTT platforms. And the question here is, how complicated, and maybe you could tell us a bit more. I mean, I'm just trying to bring this to the ground because we have the big players. In this case, we have The Zone, we have Formula One. But, you know, where I operate is uncharted territory. So I like to give people a glimpse and an idea of how complicated it is to actually replicate some of these strategies. In this case, The Zone is it's an OTT deal. But you and I know that not everybody has access to an OTT platform, or they don't have the resources to set up an OTT platform. So how complicated is to get an OTT deal or to set up your own OTT venture, you think, for tier two, tier three sports entity?
Yeah, it's interesting, because I talk about this a lot in the Australian market, and there's some parallels that we can sort of draw here. You know, historically, broadcasting is an expensive game. You know, anyone listening, and I guarantee there are some broadcasters, perhaps competitors of mine, maybe even listening to this, and guys around the world who know all about broadcasting. Traditionally, it's an expensive space. Cable TV, the infrastructure required, running your cables, running the satellites. Cable and linear TV is usually the state-owned or the very wealthy large-scale corporations are running it. The disruptor thing is 100% accurate, because what this has allowed is a lower or second tier of broadcaster coming in. Obviously, it's very rarely something that someone on the street can do, someone with very limited, you know, cash. You know, you can't do it with $100, for example. But it is far more in reach of organizations than it previously was. When you look at the costs of running an OTT platform compared to cable TV, it's unparalleled. A good example would be, you know, the Australian market is very slow to move to the OTT network because, much like most or large, a lot of markets, there's big groups that control that world. In Australia, it's Fox Sports and the linear TV platforms. And for these guys, you know, Fox, as an example, they used to charge $100, $120 a customer to sign up for their entire package. That'd be sport, that'd be entertainment. It's a lot. And they were the only cable TV operator. I know some regions have multiple, so there's high competition, but it's not unique to Australia that this exists. And what happened was, when OTT came in, which is through Optus Sport here in Australia, they took the Premier League off them. They introduced that for $15 a month versus $100, $120. Less infrastructure. You can watch it on your internet. You don't need a especially for Australia because it's so vast, you don't need a conventional cable network or satellite dish to actually access the content. As long as you had internet connection, you could access it. And in that time, Foxtel had to introduce their own, so they introduced Kayo. Kayo is interesting because a lot of people would have left Fox to go to Kayo, from $120 a month to $20 a month. That's a big hit to their hip pocket. And these companies, and as anyone knows who've worked with major corporations, they are typically a bit laborious and slow in the way they move and shift and change. So you can imagine this huge quarter drop in a large chunk of their core market that they previously controlled. So their costs and their return on investment is just dropping dramatically. And that's largely in part due to the cost efficiencies in running OTT. You don't need large-scale broadcasting spaces. You don't need heavy camera equipment. When you're broadcasting events or pre-shot content, you don't need to post-produce in enormous studios like it was before. Internet coverage in a lot of markets is improving, especially in developing markets. There are some regions where it would be complex, but when you're looking at OTT in a space, you know, areas that we often work in, Alan, where, you know, Central America, for example, it's much easier for these leagues to actually entertain the concept of running their own broadcasting, because all you need these days is a basic camera, because they're capable of shooting broadcast level quality content, whether it's a studio show or even live matches. No longer are the days where you need a $500,000 camera and a $250,000 lens to produce, you know, tier two content. You can do it with basic gear that you can actually pick up at your camera shop. So this whole shift makes it more accessible. I know I'm using a lot of Australian examples that might not work for those who don't know it, but there's a second tier football competition here in Australia called the NPL, National Premier Leagues. It's effectively our second division. There's no pro rel, but it's a semi-professional.
That's football.
Football, yeah. So there's no money in it. really compared to the A-League or other professional leagues. So it's largely in terms of its space mimics a lot of emerging markets, semi-professional. They have their own OTT channel now.
Really?
Because, yeah, they run their own. They broadcast all their games. They're all commentated. And the way they're able to do it is because they can have, you know, you can use camera gear you can buy at the local shops with a decent enough zoom, just get a good operator and a tripod, feed it into a computer and send it off over the internet. And that could be broadcast and watched anywhere in the world through MPL TV. That's a great example because there's not much money at that level of the game here. And if you take that model and you apply that to, you know, an emerging market or an emerging sport in another region, they could very easily do it. Now, we're still talking about probably a couple hundred thousand to set it all up, camera gear. There's logistics involved with getting commentary and whether you centralize your production hub or whether you do it domestic or on site and the cost of some of that equipment. But compare that, call it hypothetically for argument's sake, $500,000 experiment, a full platform, full producing, everything versus what it once was, a $5 million experiment to broadcast your content. It's a stark contrast.
Right, right. But I still have to challenge you on there because...
Please. Yeah.
Being from experience, yes. I mean, setting up an OTT, there are solutions. I remember when I was Washington-based a year ago, I found a great OTT provider, a local provider that was really great in terms of cost-effective. It was amazing. I mean, there are really... You can find OTT solutions for less than $1,000. So yeah, that should not be an excuse. So great. I mean, you can start doing all the numbers there. If you're probably not the zone or you're probably not Formula One, there's definitely a product for you. I mean, you have Prime, better products, of course, with automation nowadays, some Prime Pix, you have Pixelot and all these great solutions, which is great. But there is something for you now. That's when it comes to the OTT. That's when it comes to the platform. But when it comes to production, that's where it gets a bit more expensive. So as I mentioned before, there are some tools out there that will automate your product, probably give you an MVP, you know, minimum viable product that it's enough and meets the minimum criteria for you to get a broadcast out there. But the question is, so if I have a rugby league and I go and I start this journey and I get an OTT platform, you know, for a year, it's going to set me back at least $12,000 if I'm in a tier three level. And then I'm talking about production, and I probably have to invest 50 to 70,000. That's probably going to set me back 100,000. Great. How can you leverage? And this is where, you know, we're actually living this exercise, you and me. How can you leverage a loan? How can you leverage a loan that 100,000 or that 100,000, 20,000 from just subscriptions? Because that's not going to work. You know, I just don't want people to get the wrong idea that, sure, I'm going to set up I'm enthused, right? I heard Alan Michael said that, you know, I heard another podcast say, hey, you just go get a platform and off you go.
Yeah. Sell my house and then buy an OTT platform. Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to get my neighbor to shoot it up for my iPhone, you know, go to a scaffold and I'm off a go. Great. It's just 120,000. But no, you know, to be honest, I mean, I'm wondering how the zone is actually going back to the zone, which actually started this conversation. I'm actually really curious of what the model might look like from the zone. And I'm going to go ahead and venture out on how this probably looks like from a commercial perspective. You know, how can you monetize this deal that the Zone is bringing? Because the Zone actually is subscriber based. Now that's their main revenue. But is it a loan? Do you think those are the only revenue drivers? Because, you know, I'm thinking
definitely not
social media integration in there, digital asset development for sure. I would capitalize over any digital asset going through socials as well that I could probably integrate a brand into. I'm sure there's video integration as well through other cross-platform system apart from the zone and extending into socials, which is an uncharted territory as well that not everybody's using nowadays, and they should. And if you're not, you're probably leaving money on the table as well if you're not using your social media to capitalize over all the content your club, league, or broadcast is generating. So that's... I'm just trying to figure out what the model for the zone is. rather than subscription. Because we understand a zone, you pay a subscription, you get exclusive content. But do you think subscription alone is going to pay and cover all that deal?
Definitely not. And you know what's interesting? The fact you brought that up, actually, you know, the whole thing, and I'll bring it back to design, but I'm going to walk all the way back again. We're just walking back and forth here. It's like Benny Hill skit. Bringing it back to that MPL one, right? Because the MPL don't charge a subscription, so they don't make money on that. They actually make money on the other side, which is commercial inventory. And that's something that I think is a word of caution for those out there, you know, who, as you say, have listened and have gone, oh, yeah, I can start an OTT network tomorrow. The thing they need to know is, unless you have tier one content, you're very unlikely to sell significant amounts of subscriptions and you're very unlikely to recoup your costs. You know, I've worked with the network and I've worked with other networks as well that have done similar to this, where when you pick up certain rights, there's almost two categories. And, you know, I might be annoying some broadcast techs talking about this because this may be the secrets that they've got. But in a lot of cases, you've got your tier one rights, your big ones, your Premier League, I'm talking top scale, Premier League, F1, Champions League. Those drive subscriptions on their own in most markets. And same with MLB and NFL, doesn't matter what sport, it's the top tier of it. But then you've got other content that is only worth money if it's combined with something else, usually in terms of subscriptions. They're not going to drive subs. Things like, and I'll use football as an example. Say you're an OTT platform and I'll use a market that we don't play in so people can't just guess whether we're talking about anything we're doing, but South Africa. You've got the English Premier League. Great, that's driving subs. People are going to watch that. But then you pick up something like what would be a good example? The Eredivisie in the Netherlands. That's a great standard of football. I would watch that personally as a fan. But I pay to subscribe just to watch that or just to watch that and maybe another tier two or three? No, I'm not going to. Would I pay that to watch the Brazilian Serie A? Maybe more so, but I'm not going to pay for that alone. Its value is in the collective, which is where guys like DAZN, you know, it's very hard for some broadcasters to actually quantify the value of a league. There are detailed analytics that allow you to do that. And, you know, that's very heavy consultants. Alan, you're someone that actually can quantify that kind of stuff. But on its own, if you were to take a certain package on its own, you would value that at a different rate to if you're valuing it within an overall portfolio of rights. So drawing back to the OTT conversation, you know, if you've got a local baseball league that's up and coming in say Egypt, and you think, oh great, I'm going to start an OTT platform. Sorry, people probably aren't going to subscribe to watch it. You can do it for free if it's and that's the other thing. That's the other side of it, right? Because the MPL, I'll draw it back to them. The MPL doing this broadcasting showcases the quality. It showcases the production side of it. It showcases the fact that the league is accessible and increases the brand awareness for it. But that then allows that competition to generate its own broadcast deal in the future, because they have the data, the analytics, they have the eyeballs. And on the flip side, and drawing back to the point that you made, other revenue streams, because you're broadcasting your games now, your ads, your pre-rolls, mid-rolls, post-rolls, you've got your overlays, your commercial inventory, which you build up in a proper strategy when you produce it, will probably maybe break you even depending on your competition and your market. That's where you build that, you know. The mistake can be made for a new broadcaster thinking subs alone will make me money. It won't. Yeah. It may get you close, but you need other things. And, you know, I'm sure over the course of this podcast, we'll talk about some, and future podcasts, we'll talk about other things like betting rights and other stuff like that that adds to that. But going back to DAZN now, I think it's an interesting one because it probably is quite tricky for them to quantify. Are there that many super fans today for Sonoda? He's a new F2 driver. Is he going to drive that subscription? Probably not. But F1 is commercially such a powerful tool. Brands clamor over themselves to get associated with these drivers and with these teams. There's a marketing opportunity for DAZN in that respect. Nothing in their releases state that they're running ad-free coverage of anything. So for them, the commercial inventory that they can sell on top of that, that's going to drive their revenue higher. In addition, the data they collect, which feeds into the advertising stuff, being OTT, they're getting all the details. You cross-link that with your social, you cross-link that with other data sources that you have, and then you get and analyze all that, and then you can get an understanding of what your market is for Sonoda fans or Japanese F1 fans. You might find some correlations with a certain brand, and you go, well, we have X amount of people that also like this brand. that allows you in OTT space to go to that brand and go, well, we can leverage that amount of followers because they're all watching our platform, Sonoda, but they also like you, so pay us more money. You know, all these other things, they don't exist in conventional linear TV, because all they could do back then was a Nielsen poll out the front of a train station asking, do you watch this? Well, do you like any of these brands? It's not that scientific compared to what we have now in the OTT space, which is why it's such a good disruptor, because they can really fine tune everything.
Yeah, especially you said it. Pretty much the description here is of what I'm going to take from this exercise or from this segment that we approach here is narrowing down from Sonoda to tier two, tier three players is why should I sell my house and start my own OTT platform is, we're just going to be honest here. There's not going to be ROI in year one. You're not going to break even probably, but you will have access to data. And that's the goal here. I mean, your property should be data driven, because once you're data driven, I remember when I was in Telefónica and the telco, people would come up to me with a vague or empty proposal. And you know, I remember being on the property side, now being on the other side, so to say. I still assist two parties. But pretty much, your offer has to make sense. I mean, it's basic. Hey, look, you have a brand, right? I have a platform. My platform can reach, you know, and people need to understand that there's KPIs and you need to reach those KPIs. And if you don't show KPIs, your property, you're not showing the worth of your property. And everybody's looking for the same KPIs, and that's reach, that's views, that's your demographics. What is it? You know, what do you have? And that's how this magic in this happens. And the magic of course, OTT being, okay, well, there are some interesting demographic markers that we want to reach to. We will do this through Sonoda. Once we get data collection, data-driven, and data itself is actually sellable, probably not tier two, tier three players know this, but there's a way to commercialize data, you know, bookmaker integration and all these other features that will probably.
And just to add to that as well, before someone jumps on their Excel spreadsheet and then sends that to someone and sells it immediately, there are legislations that prevent you from, it has to be done properly. If you just sell your Excel spreadsheet of your subscribers, you will be in a lot of trouble. So check your local state regulations.
Yeah, probably. Good, you mentioned that. But, you know, all I mean, and I don't mean only data as in, I mean, data from your base. In this case, we're talking about you running an OTT yourself. I don't mean that kind of data. I mean performance data from the sport itself. I mean, in this case, the zone drives performance data of their visitors. But there's actually the opportunity to commercialize data from a club or from a league, you know, to connect with bookmaker integrations. So there's all these opportunities out there, which, you know, it's going to be interesting to actually keep seeing how the Sonoda deal unfolds. I'm actually very curious to see the different revenue streams that the Zone is probably going to use. I actually, as you mentioned before, I what we do in some of the services we provide to our clients is actually value a property through different metrics that we use through AI tools and other analytic tools, and basically mostly on the digital world, because it's quantifiable, it's robust data that you could rely on. So I'm really keen on seeing how this deal unfolds for the Zone, and I guess I don't know if I'll read about if it was a good deal in terms of ROI or not, but it narrows down to that. But going back to, you know, T2, T3 people, there is a way to replicate the same strategy, I would say, and it has to do with replicating what bigger players are doing and a predefined market strategy to open up new spaces. Because, look, before, people were competing only in their domestic territory. And you know about this. I mean, your OTT was only competing in the Australian market itself. And then you opened yourself a door through an offshore property. And it's the same with everything else. I mean, in this case, the Zone has probably targeted a specific market they want to penetrate. And what better way than to have a winning figure than Sonoda to go in it. And I'm sure they have their markers pretty defined already. And hopefully this deal is going to drive them there. But what I take from here is OTT is a platform that will give you, not probably on year one based on subscription or ROI, but it will give you data. And once you have data, you are more capable to drive a winning deal with a potential partner or sponsor than with just, you know, an open format proposal. And two is Sunoda and market penetration strategy is something that's very much replicable at other scales.
Well, that's a really good segue, Alan, into topic two, which is another OTT-based topic. And effectively, it's European brands have been targeted for the CONMEBOL. I always pronounce that wrong. CONMEBOL. I always say CONMEBOL. Yeah. It's CONMEBOL qualifiers. Yeah. Using virtual advertising. And I think this is interesting because it highlights the power of OTT and the future of sports advertising in the same way that Google revolutionized internet and search engine advertising. So effectively, in short, a marketing group which holds the TV advertising rights for the South American qualifiers for the FIFA World Cup. They have a deal with a online sponsorship company from Israel, Stads, and it will enable European brands to quickly buy pitch-side advertising at games, and it's using like an online booking system. So if anyone listening's ever used Google Ads or Facebook Ads, we're quite literally talking about football at one of its highest levels sponsorship through the same type of method. So their claim is that the platform will allow brands to programmatically buy bespoke perimeter board packages. So obviously the perimeter board is the ad board that goes around the stadium for those who might not know. And effectively what it opens the door to is brands being able to target their market a little bit more using the power of OTT. It's a really interesting concept because it's the next step in sports advertising. It's not just when you watch the World Cup, Visa, McDonald's, whatever other brand sponsor, I always forget. But you could be seeing stuff that's actually related to you. It's, you know, some people are scared, like, oh, my phone's listening to me and all that. But all that data driven from your other activities, you know, it could be what you clicked on, what's aggregated through Google, Facebook, what you typically share and like on platforms that you've given access to. You can now receive tailored advertising while watching Brazil versus Argentina in a World Cup qualifier, and something localized to you or relevant to you comes up on that advertising board as if it's at the stadium. It's pretty futuristic stuff, but it is the natural next step in advertising on television.
Yeah, and I think it has to do with what we were speaking about before, you know, the system being data-driven, which is the key element here if pretty much you want to take up your sports entity to the next level. Pretty much have to back it up with data back insights. And in this case, I really liked what this company did. It's called Stats with a D, as in dot. So their website, I'm actually looking at it right now, is stats.io. And they have a pretty nice video actually feature that you could toy around and zoom in and zoom out. And it's beautiful technology, you know, typical Israel product, you know, high-tech integration and data, which is one of my favorites, you know, me being an engineer and working a lot with data, with data to back up any proposal or valuation. This is, I think, where everything is being driven in the future. I think it actually generates a new field. Unfortunately, what I see, though, is that you will have big properties. In this case, you have CONMEBOL, and then you have other properties like European football, Formula One, so on, so on. Actually grasping this kind of technology, but making the gap bigger between smaller entities and the bigger entities. So it's beautiful, though. You know, I'm personally excited to see this. If you go to their website, you see Maestro Del Piero there. So pretty good marketing and strategy on them. And you see Del Piero there just picking up a bunch of tees and Torino Stadium. It's beautiful. And we'll see how it goes, of course. There's a very interesting feature I'm reading about here is actually allows you via 3D to look at a different ad than what you're watching on the pitch. I don't know if you mentioned that, but it's pretty interesting. Imagine I'm watching it live, and I'm probably in Brazil or Argentina watching this, and then I'm seeing an ad myself. But when it comes to the OTT, I'm seeing a complete different ad that is targeted according to my insights. Now that's amazing. That's really
it's awesome.
Yeah, and that has to be done through 3D technology, and I'm sure pretty soon we're going to start seeing VR field with a complete different broadcast. It's going to be open into a VR world, so you could pretty much be in multi spaces at the same time. So it's great. You know, I think this is powerful technology. Again, being data driven, it's important. They do mention that it will be feasible and accessible for everyone. I wonder, they don't let you see pretty much the prices, of course. There is an option to explore the platform. Now, I'm wondering, you know, I'm sure they have tier one, tier two, and tier three matches. I'm wondering how much my brand could probably go there for. I mean, I'm sure they have opportunities on the OTT alone. Now, imagine if they geolocate this. I mean, that's interesting, because then I can buy an ad specifically if I am, you know, Sunoda or DAZN. I could specifically buy an ad for a specific region, and that will literally make my offer competitive, you know, rather than buying an ad that's, you know, for everyone, because that's the problem. Maybe if you want to get your company across or your OTT broadcaster there, and you want to put probably Sportsbet on a big Argentina-Brazil game, I mean, imagine that's in terms of reach on the national stadium and in terms of international TV rights, that's huge. But if you want to tailor that specific, and I want to be, and I have a market strategy somewhere in South Africa, as you mentioned before, and I only want to be seen in that specific market, then that's going to make the price very competitive just for me. You know, it's going to make it accessible for me to just be on that broadcast. So this is the kind of, I think, features that Stach is going to come up with. It's definitely opening up a whole new ballgame in terms of advertisement, and we'll see where it goes. I don't know if you see this. Now, you being an OTT broadcaster yourself, Michael, how can you integrate this? I mean, how can you, for example, integrate this in your OTT platform?
It's pretty tricky. It's an interesting one, because at the moment, virtual signboards and advertising exists, even in conventional TV. You know, you have your broadcast premixer. Obviously, I'm not the biggest tech when it comes to the actual in-depth broadcast tech, but there's systems and softwares that you calibrate pre-game, and you can have your banners, but they're normally static. They're done at that end. They're done in pre-production, and the feed that goes out has that already on there. It's almost as if you'd have this calibrated permanent green screen, because you have to calibrate the camera so it knows where those banners actually are. And this green screen, almost at the OTT side, whether it's what I don't know yet is whether it's produced in the middle or whether it's produced at the OTT end. That is probably more complex. It probably is produced in the middle, but it does require the analytics from the platform to actually draw what that user data is, or the relevant geolocation data, because to an OTT platform, or rather the aggregator in the middle, all they would really know is that this person is accessing the content. They may not have the data for location sent at that point. So in terms of, I mean, they've been very vague in the way they're explaining it. Obviously, it's probably proprietary information, but my understanding and my thinking is it probably is done at the OTT platform side. So if you're an OTT provider that is one of the many white label solutions that are out there, they must be pulling the data and then plugging it in via their API, so that when that feed is being pulled, it's superimposing the relevant content in real time. And that raises another question, you know, because you're adding an extra layer to this. So if you're in a region with limited internet connectivity, you're going to have issues with running that level of data that's been post-produced and sent, or it's going to introduce a significant delay in the broadcast, whether it's, and when I say significant, it could be 10, 15 seconds. But in the days of Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, 10, 15 seconds is a long time. You'll know about a goal before it goes in by a significant amount if you introduce that on top of your typical 7 to 15 second delay on OTT anyway. So it's interesting how they do it. I assume it's not going to be too content heavy. Otherwise, I don't see that working in some markets. You'd have no use case in a market with really, really low internet connection. But then it would come down to Stad's technology being able to plug into all the different providers. It's not like all the OTT platforms are all one software. There's 15, 18, 20 different providers that create OTT systems. and they all need to share either the right data or plug in the right system into it. That's a lot of R&D and development and relationship building with these groups to actually make it happen. You know, some of these groups already work with detailed analytics like Google 360, Google Ads, programmatic ads that they run through their own proprietary system. So it is interesting because in theory, it sounds really good, but logistically, in terms of implementation, it's quite tricky. It's not as straightforward as it might sound. It's almost the perfect world of sports broadcasting. And I can totally see this being something that will be completely normal in 15, 20 years when everything's caught up and everyone's trying to play in this space. But right now, they're pioneering something. And I think one of the tricky things as well is that this requires volume to be useful to either a broadcast, not so much a broadcaster, but to the groups that are actually buying into it. They need these platforms to have a significant amount of pull. Otherwise, if only 10 people are using the OTT platform where this gets access to, it's not actually worth anything to them because they're not getting the reach that they might be paying for. And then on the flip side, the group, the competition, Comnable, the relevant member associations, it's not worth it to them because no one's signing up. It's a bit of a chicken and egg. It's kind of a round circle. Which goes first? So it's an interesting experiment. I don't see it being mainstream immediately, but I think it's so interesting because it is the future. It does require volume because you're allowing, as you said, Alan, smaller players, and it removes some of the cost barriers because you can localize so much of your ads. You could be a coffee shop, and if you had enough money, you could actually localize specifically to a certain region. But that requires significant uptake of customer base for that to be worth it to you. And then to the rights holders, that requires a significant amount of businesses opting in and using it for it to be worth more than their conventional advertising method. So it's interesting, and it's going down the line of the disruption to the typical advertising norms and your typical hoardings and signage, which is cheaper to implement as well in theory because you're just paying for a fixed banner and that probably sits there for an entire, you know, football season or period or depending on the advertising terms. But if it has the right uptake and they have the buy-in from the right OTT players, then it can work. And I can see this working. You know, I draw back to Formula One. Formula One TV, as an example, they've got their own platform in markets where they don't have TV rights deals, and some regions you can watch the whole season on there. Because they would have a significant uptake already, if they introduce that service, it probably would work because to these brands, they could localize to individual states in the United States. There's enough people watching it. They already have a use case. They already have a membership base on their OTT platform that they run. But it's interesting because Comnable, how many different OTT companies, broadcasters are out there broadcasting that content? And are you going to be able to get them all on board with this software and technology? There could be 10, 15 running into it.
I think commercialization of this is just massive. I mean, let me recap to someone like my mother or the people I talk to and engage on a daily basis, which come from a heavy sport background, not professional background. You know, I mean, let's face it, Michael, you know, 1%, 2%, less than 10% of the sports ecosystem is professional. I mean, you have FIFA, you have UEFA, you have Formula One. Then the rest of the world, I mean, they don't have really professionals working in these entities. It's people that, you know, they're used to be athletes or involved with the sport at some point. So to break it down, to explain it to someone out there on who's not from the industry, there is the opportunity for you to watch, I quote, TV, well, not being TV, but really being an OTT platform, so to say, a Netflix or The Zone. You're watching that, and now you're going to have the opportunity to see your ad, your specific ad that says, Alan Chamorro is great. I can get to run that in a specific place to a specific user. And how this works is because whatever I have there, whatever metrics I have gathered from the OTT platform, in this case, let's just call it my DAZN subscription or my Netflix. I signed up through my Gmail account. So naturally, there are some Google Analytics related to my account. And it says Alan likes football and he likes ice cream. So once I'm tuning in into this football broadcast, I'm going to see a commercial for a specific amount of time, whatever my money could buy at the time, tailored to a person's with my taste. That's what it narrows down to. That it's super specific targeting. It's scary at some point. But it's great, you know. That's what this tool is doing, just so to explain to everyone. But the challenge is, now the challenge for whoever's marketing this or selling this is, how do you commercialize? That's huge. I mean, how many, what's the inventory for you? What are the opportunities? They're endless. So imagine I have the rights to commercialize Spain versus Costa Rica on my OTT. And I'm in charge of specific territory, and that's, let's say, Costa Rica, right? Right. So everybody in Costa Rica that wants to have an ad there, I could do it. What are the endless analytics or demographics that can go into? I mean, you can target anyone. So I'm thinking that the hardest part on their side, on the brand side, or it's pretty much commercializing such a product like this with. It has an endless reach, you know. It's like having an endless supply of tires, and I don't know if there is enough demand for it. And because what it narrows down to is, and I help some sports entities reach value through their portfolio, because usually their portfolio is just broad. I put a lot of data in it. I quantify it. I put value in it, and great. You have a beautiful product, which is the case. It's a beautiful product and it has all these capabilities. How do you commercialize that? That's usually very hard to do. Of course, when it comes to football, we all know it's a lot easier, but I'm just trying to scale this and see if it's something feasible. And I have my doubts about how they're planning to roll this out. You know, I really would like to see how this plays out in a bigger market other than the CONMEBOL market, which, you know, I mean, South America, it isn't the biggest economy in the world, you know. It's not really competing with North American economy or Japanese economy. So it's going to be really interesting to see. Of course, there's a lot of things to be determined here, a lot of criteria when it comes to pricing, when it comes to reach and accessibility, or how I, as a person that's interested in having my ad there, have access to this. You know, I'd really like to see. Because yeah. What I understand is that there's a platform, and then pretty much there's going to be an opportunity for me to say, I see it something like buying a LinkedIn ad or a Google ad. Hey, look, there's this opportunity for you to place an ad here specifically this minute from this minute, and it's going to reach this amount of people. You can invest $5, $10. So if it's going to be something that's going to be competing with those kind of spaces, so to say, Facebook, Google, and all these metrics, I think this is going to be, you know, a really big player in the future, because I don't see any of the big players like Facebook or Google going into things like this. And pretty much we're going to have another player that's going to open up all this sports field, and that's really going to open up the advertising field, and we'll see how it goes. Really curious to follow more about it.
So am I. I think it's a really interesting, you know, future look into the state of sports advertising. But let's drag this down a level a little bit. Let's look at tier three. Let's talk about Real Esteli, which is a client of yours. So we're going to touch on a client of yours and talk a little bit about that. So probably for those who are listening who might not know, let's talk a little bit about Esteli, you know, where they're based. Obviously, I know. We've talked about Esteli many times on the phone. But, you know, talk it for the listeners at home, or at work, or wherever you happen to be listening in the car. Talk to us about Real Esteli.
Well, you know, Real Esteli is it's a side competing in Central America, specifically in Liga Primera, right? So it is one of the big clubs there in Nicaragua. It's one of the big names there. But what's important to know, it's the big jump or the big success, so to say, that the club is having. I mean, now they're more than a club. They've branched out into an institution. They're playing now in a Champions League of CONCACAF. This is a tier one competition from CONCACAF, because CONCACAF has a similar system to UEFA. They have, so to say, a Champions League and an Europa League. In the case of CONCACAF, they have a Champions League as well, and then they have a league as well. So Real Esteli now access to the tier one competition, so that's great. In terms of branching out, they've branched out into basketball, and actually their basketball franchise is now competing in the Basketball Champions League of the Americas. So I think the name pretty much says it all. They're competing in the international club competition, so to say, from Mexico all the way to Argentina. So I would say that's a success in the club. But the success itself is not the club performance on the pitch or on the track, but it's off it. Its commercial performance and its value has gone up more than 500%. And a lot of it has to do exactly with all the things we've been speaking about. And it has to do with adding robust data into the mix. And one of the problems that Real Estelí was having, which is a problem that's probably happening to a lot of people, and this actually happened pre-COVID, and this is pretty interesting. By the time COVID came, the club was prepared. Pre-COVID, there was a domestic situation in the country, and what happened was the club was losing sponsorships. They were losing literally sponsors. So they came up, we had some talks, and they come up to me and say, what can we do? I mean, we're losing sponsorship value. We're literally losing some sponsors, and that's direct revenue. What do you think what do you think could do around here? So we did an audit of the club, and the first thing we found was that the club had a strong DNA. You know, at its core, they were really strong when it comes to content generation, and they were really digital. They have that drive where their team is young, and it's very driven into that sense. So I think that was the biggest value we found. The biggest gold nugget was there. But pretty much their strategy was just to generate content in terms of communication, in terms of let's say, let's give news to the fan. And what I did was suggest to steer that into monetization strategies through their socials, which is what started bringing up the results. One of the first things I did was bring a partnership with Blinkfire Analytics. Now, I know there's a lot of solutions out there, but Blinkfire Analytics, to me, it's very user-friendly. They have robust data, of course. And pretty much for everyone listening out there, if you are publishing something from your OTT or your club, Michael, that has a value. Just how we were saying the stats, pretty much what they do is the same as Google. They operate under the same model. How much people are you reaching? How much money do you want to put in there? We'll reach this amount of people. It's the same with social media. It's the same with every digital asset your club can generate. In this case, the idea was to value how much the club was generating. So we brought up artificial intelligence tool that exactly told us how that was performing. After that, you treat it pretty much like a production line. So you have Twitter, you have Instagram, you have YouTube. So, okay, let's see how much YouTube is reaching. Let's see how much views is generating. Let's see what markets is going into. Same with Twitter, same with Instagram, same with Facebook. Of course, you benchmark with the best, and the best is the North American clubs. You have the Mexican sites. You have MLS clubs competing on a bigger scale, of course, on a bigger markets and a bigger pool. They could generate a lot, but pretty much if you look at Real Estelí now, they're in the top 10. They're in the top 10 in YouTube. They're in the top 10, top 20 at least, in pretty much every KPI when it has to do with engagement, with views, with reach. So they have outstanding performance from being a small side. And we can compare this to the case we were speaking about, Eibar. Eibar found a way to do market strategy penetration through their Japanese players. And Real Estelí is not doing a market strategy penetration yet. Not a strong one, I believe. But what they have done strongly is value their assets, understand how they are performing, identify those assets and say, okay, this asset can generate an X amount of money. I did not know that. And a lot of people don't know that, actually. A lot of clubs, a lot of leagues don't know that when you put content out there, that content has a reach. Now, the challenge here, of course, being you build a lot of value, you build a lot of metrics, you work according to KPIs, you hit those KPIs, but the challenge here is how do you translate that into revenue? How do you monetize that? That's the biggest part, and this is where we were talking about stats, that I feel the challenge is how to commercialize that, because commercializing something is pretty hard. First, you need to generate value to it. Else is just vague. Even though it's not robust. It's based on magic. But once you put robust data into it, then okay, you have something. This is data. This is backed up by data. Okay, great. Love it. And then how do you commercialize it? And this is at the point where we are with the club. The club has reached around a value of more than $500,000 through their socials alone. Now that they are performing in an OTT, then the rights have been sold by the league. You know, it's interesting to see them, and you probably have more access to their data than I do when it comes to how they are performing, but it's interesting to see how they perform in other markets. But the idea being here that the next step is a market penetration strategy where they probably acquire players from certain regions, which they have before. They have acquired Mexican players, and I've seen how that drives up their socials in this region, specifically in Mexico being a huge market, of course. This is the case of Real Estelí, and I think this case could be easily, not easily, but it could be and should be attempted to replicate in similar regions with the same model in other markets, you know. And if you narrow down everything, if you narrow down Sonora, if you narrow down stats, and you take it down to tier two, tier three Real Estelí, it's all connected, you know. It's all the same tools. It's all OTT. It's all data-driven. It's all market strategy. It's all having the same KPI performance. And at the end, if you don't have a market strategy, you know, if you don't want to penetrate other markets, which was the case of Real Estelí, pretty much they were being dependent solely on their domestic territory. What happened was we started creating new engagement markers, new drivers, addressing new territories, and that opened up the space. Once we opened up the space, the sponsorship space opened up a lot. And it's pretty much what Stats is doing. And it's pretty much what Sonora is doing. So that actually, if you look at it as a funnel, it aligns the same. So this was, you know, I think the winning case of Real Estelí. They were a club from a small country in an emerging league like Liga Primera. How does a club like this reach $500,000 or more in value? How do they get to generate that kind of money to their sponsors? Well, you know, the first thing is open up your market strategy to other territories. Stop relying on the domestic territory alone. That's one thing. The other thing they did is they aligned everything and treat their socials as a production line. Everything there has a drive. Everything there has a goal. Pretty much, of course, naturally, is to still drive fan engagement. You know, the idea is to bring the fan closer to the action. The fan is the core of this equation. But pretty much driving the fan closer to the action while integrating your sponsors. And that's been, I think, the magic formula for Real Estelí. And now Real Estelí is shooting up deals with international partnerships and stakeholders that I'm not allowed to say it, of course. But it's pretty much putting on in the map someone like Real Estelí with the likes of Mexican clubs and MLS clubs. And it's pretty interesting to see and should be encouraging for everybody out there who is handling a tier two, tier three league.
Yeah. And do you know what's really interesting? I mean, well, one point I'm going to make, I was going to make it earlier, but I didn't want to break your funk. You're on a roll. The thing about top 10, I think, is interesting to mention, because you weren't just saying that as a figure of speech. Like, you showed me the stats and the numbers. They quite literally are in the top 10. They are, which is insane, because there are 20 odd clubs in the MLS, and there's, you know, 40 odd really commercial clubs in Mexico and other sort of regions. So it's a huge credit to actually reach those sort of heights. But the other thing I wanted to touch on very briefly is that you mentioned that they were a content machine and they were doing this and doing that. The thing that I think people misunderstand, and this applies in any business. I've worked in a range of startups in different industries, and people too easily silo their operations. But things like marketing and your strategy and your content creation, they aren't separate to commercialization. They are actually integral to commercialization. It's not a concept where you call us up and go, hey, Alan, I want to start commercializing things. And you go, great. You can start with a blank slate. I should add that. Like, you can, yes. You know, you can start from nothing. But what makes it easier and a quicker endeavor is that you are already doing things like good content creation, good social management. You've got some level of strategy when it comes to all that. You can build that, but it will take longer. But these things don't run independently. You can't just go, hey, Alan, can you do some commercialization? Oh, we're not going to produce any content, though. It's magic. Oh, wow, look at all this money come in. It's like, well, if you're not going to invest in that part of the business or in this part, then you can't increase your commercial inventory. You can't have these, you know, greater opportunities. And I think the other thing is, you mentioned Liga Primera and they struck the international broadcast deal and they've been doing these sort of things. These sort of things are integral across the board. Like, and I know I'm using a league as an example versus a club, but from a league perspective, for a league to get a good broadcast deal, you need good production to begin with. Otherwise, no one's going to buy your product or no one's going to renew your product, I should say. So these sort of things, if you don't create that basis, it's like a shop window. Or if you're a football player, I'll use that as an example, and you're going out to the transfer window and you want to move, but you're just not bothered to play. Well, who's going to buy you? Manchester United aren't going to buy you from Aston Villa. You don't want to be at Aston Villa and you're playing like crap. But
yeah, performance.
If you don't put yourself in the shop window, you're not going to get there. And that's the important thing with commercialization, is it's all about these brands wanting to associate with this other brand. Why would they do that? You know, what's the drivers behind that brand making those decisions? Obviously, having very capable people to facilitate those deals and the connections is one component of it. But that doesn't complete the sales. They need to see something that they're effectively buying into, whether it's a project, success, or a methodology, or a strategy, that they all sort of interlink with each other.
Yeah, and I think just to add what you're saying, I mean, you said it before. I mean, in this case, it doesn't work magically that you come and say, well, you need to replicate, I'd like to replicate this. Yes, okay. But as I said, we made an audit at the beginning, and the audit showed that the club was strong in a digital core. I mean, that was... They had a young team who was very digitally driven, and they like generating good content, and they're always striving to generate new things and innovative ideas. They're heavy in communication. Actually, if you look at the club now doesn't say Real Estelí is a football club. It says actually Real Estelí is a leading generation content institution. You know, they put themselves up there as an entertainment institution already. They're beyond sports. I mean, yes. Sports is at its core, but they extended out in a 2-year period, and the value that's been driven to the club is amazing. But that happened because an audit was performed and it was found that communications was a core component of their success. It might be that another club wants a solution and says, hey, look, I have no content, you know, I have no strategy, I have no team for this. But I sell a lot of shirts in every game. I'm selling a lot of shirts for some reason, and I get a lot of phone calls from people that want to buy my shirts in LA because for some reason my club is big in LA and Sacramento and California. Oh, you know, there's a strategy for you. Maybe that's your solution. That's your curated solution for you. Well, we should expand then. You know, we should start looking into e-commerce. We should start looking into merchandising avenues, into partnerships that will create you a bigger platform for you to sell. So everybody has a different solution. In the case of Real Estelí, it was this. It was that they already were having this. And pretty much it just needed to be aligned. And once the club understood what they were producing had a value, they were like, oh, okay, so this has a value. It's just pretty much giving them a framework and a guideline to follow. And this is what really drove up their value. And now that value is slowly, mind you, starting to show its return on investment and its results. So, for example, sponsorships were renewed. So that's a good thing. The main sponsor was increased once they saw the value and it could be quantifiable. So that could be a success story. And I think the end now is, how do you put a club on a domestic level to an international level, you know, even though it has the value? I think that's the challenge where we are now. But actually, it's a good challenge. I think you want to put yourself in that position where you're saying, oh, okay, well, I actually want to compete on the international side. I still depend on the domestic territory with the traditional business model. When it comes to traditional ads, physical billboards, some signage, that's great. But you know, now the idea is to strive away the club from typical business model where you have signage on the kid, where you have physical billboards, into the digital space, into the international market. So that's what we're driving now. And I think the biggest challenge is going to be how do you compete with probably the domestic side in that territory or something else? If you're from a small country, but it's a good challenge. We're thriving every day, and I think it's good, and it should be something that all sports entities should aim at, you know.
And there's a point you made there that's really interesting, is that the way you quantify that is so contextually relevant. So what works for Real Estate Elite and the results is relevant to the market and the international reach that they're able to achieve from where they are. If you're a club in South Africa, your infrastructure is contextual to who you are, and as such, your results and your timelines and your potential returns and your strategy will differ as a result. And I think one thing that's interesting to note, and you know, because I did say that, you know, all these things are interrelated. If there's anyone listening who is very interested in Alan and my services, don't be discouraged if you don't have that. As you said, the audit, what we do at the start with always any business really, but especially in sport, is we actually have a look at what you have and what you're doing.
Yeah.
And we sort of look at it and go, well, you can do this. This is where you need to do. We put those reports out as part of the service. But it's the main difference is your timing. SDLE, because the content machine is there, it could have been, I won't put a time frame, but it was an X amount process, say 1 year process from start to finish. I actually don't know the exact time frames, but say it was 1 year. But if you don't have all that, it could be a 2 year process to get yourself to that. So these things are all achievable at any levels. You know, the Premier League have, you know, these sort of strategies in play, and it takes them a different methodology and time frame because of who they are. But smaller tier 3, tier 4 clubs and leagues and competitions, these can all be achieved. The digital age and the availability of and access to all these different tools are available to everyone, and it's just about piecing it together. And that can all be built. That infrastructure can be built to put you in those positions to generate that best return. And it's one of those things where, again, it's you go back to the beginning, you could turn this off right now and go out to your players in the paddock and start filming them and go, oh, content, we're now going to make money. Well, it needs to be strategized. It needs to be done correctly. You need to have the right inventory. And that's where, you know, I guess people like us come into it, where we actually make that happen. But that's the important thing, is it's so achievable, but if it's not done right, you're just going to disillusion yourself and go, well, I shot all this stuff and I bought this new camera for the club and I'm not making a return. Well, no, that's where we look at the strategy and how you do it differently, or where you're shooting content,
or actually you get encouraged more, you know. Let me tell you, in 2017, when I was operating in South America through my first agency there, it was a big crash and burn, you know. I'm not afraid to talk about my failures. 2017, 2016, OTT was not a thing there. Nobody was saying, yeah, oh, I'm excited to have my own OTT. Still to the day, not a lot of these clubs are operating with their own OTTs or through OTTs. So imagine 5 years ago, you know, how fast this is developing. So back in the day, I crashed and burned with my first OTT deal. A lot of people didn't understand it. They didn't know what it was. It's hard dealing with teams in places where technology is probably not a big value. So what happens is I got encouraged to learn more about the trade, and eventually it resulted in better deals. But pretty much what people have to understand here is that there is an opportunity. I mean, you and I love to talk about these things, Michael. We talk about it every day. We could record a podcast every day pretty much about all the opportunities we see coming from this. I mean, we're having fun with the Dubai project and pretty much trying to replicate the success we have in other emerging markets. So I think it's something that if anybody wants to reach out to talk about, hey, great, we can discuss it. We can advise you on it. I mean, this is pretty much just a free consultation, so to say. I mean, we love what we do, and we love to talk about it. And we just want to encourage, you know, pretty much more people to do this. I mean, personally, I tell you, my goal is to leverage the playing field. I was inspired because, you know, I come from a developing market, so to say, developing region. So it's funny. You're always seeing Team GB, Team USA, and it's great, win all the medals. But I think there's a whole lot out there. You know, there's a whole lot of other territories and a lot of other players, and not only country-wise. I mean, in a country, I mean, you're in Australia, you're in the developed market, but you have tier one, great, you have the A-League. But what happens to all the content sport? What happens to all that portfolio out there? It's not being, you know, it's not being tapped. And that's uncharted territory. And that's kind of democracy you want to get to into sports, you know, to get it all out there, give everyone a chance. The problem with why these entities are not rising is because they don't have the tools. They don't know how. And that's where we come in, you know, because we do it out of, I wouldn't say fun, but we really enjoy what we do. And, you know, pretty much this is the idea. And I hope this podcast goes in that direction, you know, to have a bigger reach, to start bringing up players, the people that want and have the drive but lack the tools to do so. That's where we come in. We'd love to hear your story, you know, probably get you on a podcast as well and see what your what your challenges are. I mean, we could probably do it on the fly, you know, a quick round of fire. Hey, we invite you to the podcast. I'm challenging you. I have this problem. What do you think could be done? Right. We'd love to hear about it.
Let's do it live.
Right. On the fly. What do you think?
On the fly. That's right. All the pressure's on.
What do you think? I think are you game for something like that?
Maybe? I'm game. Why not? I'm confident in my abilities. I've done this before.
Right.
I'll do it live.
It's a public challenge. It's a public challenge. Once this podcast goes out there, it's into the world, Michael.
Yeah, I can't renege on it now, can I? It's I've thrown the gauntlet down. It's emerging market guys out there.
You can't go back
and challenge us.
Look, there's probably going to be some sort of drone racing or auto, you know, remote racing, or who knows what's going to come on. And they're saying, hey, look, I want to get this model going. So what do you think? So it's going to be pretty much an interesting challenge.
Funny,
and we're challenging
funny you mentioned drone racing.
Yeah, it's we're challenging everybody out there.
Yeah. Everyone, honestly, take it up. Doesn't matter what sport, honestly.
Esports.
They're all applicable.
Esports.
Esports. Bring it on. I love the esports space.
Yeah,
by the way.
No.
I mean, I'm sure
definitely,
you've already done a show about it.
Yeah. We're definitely. Nah, I wouldn't say it's a show. It was a dry run. You know, I just wanted to explore what it was, what it would be like to set up an e-show. I'm an esports franchise or an esports tournament. Now we're actually very close to getting it off the ground with a client in South America. I'm trying to get that sanctioned by the governing body and do everything it takes. So I think it should be fun, but the challenge is out there. So if you're listening, we challenge you to bring on your entity into the show, and then we'll tell you. We'll do an audit on the fly, live.
Yeah, that's right. For everyone to hear our successes or potential failures, hopefully not failures. Let's be positive. I love that you brought up drone racing, because I got an ad for drone racing the other day. I find that so intriguing. I think it's German based, or it's definitely in Europe, but it looks really cool. But look, you know, we're coming to the end of this particular show. For those that have made it to the hour and a half mark, pretty much, thank you very much for still listening. We're going to be bringing you guys insights into sports business and talking a little bit about, you know, the big stories that are out there and the top line stories, like Sonoda signing for AlphaTauri, but looking at the commercial side all the way down to your tier three, what can be done, emerging market space, emerging tech, all of the above, and probably interviewing people too. You know, I've got some really interesting guys I'd love to get on and talk about their tech or what they've done or their history and their background. There's some really cool guys that you and I have both dealt with and guys that you've dealt with and that I've dealt with separately. Yeah. So there's going to be some really cool stories that we're going to share with everyone as well. So if you've made it this far, I'm sure you're pretty game to listen to those. So,
No, thank you. Thank you, Michael, for, you know, getting this together, to helping me put this together as well. I think we always enjoy our silly conversations. And, you know, I think the core here is, the message is just try it. Just try it.
Yep.
I know I'm not going to be discouraged about doing this. I was just actually, I'm listening to a podcast from, you know, Tom, our friend from Spock, and his early days in a podcast in Australia when, you know, and he was pretty much an early adopter. And I hope we are one of the early guys. I know there's a lot of a big crowd already in Spotify and all the podcasts talking about this. But, you know, I think our challenge, we'll take it to the next level and we'll see how it goes. And thank you.
I'd love to get Tom on, actually. He's someone on my list of someone I want to talk to, because his tech is awesome and his background and his experience is really cool.
We love his podcast.
Love to get him on.
Right.
And I, my final note as well, you mentioned it, don't be discouraged. I think one thing that I'll leave everyone with is, you know, you mentioned the A-League, we've mentioned some big name, you know, EPL and all that. Even the biggest guys don't always get it right. So if you aren't getting it right in your commercial space, don't look at that as a failure of your product. Everyone, even the biggest organizations, FIFA, Comnibol, this could, that thing we talked about today could be one of those failures, but they all make these mistakes. But the thing is, it's all about giving it a go when it comes to that commercial space and what you do with it. So, but you can bring some friends along the way.
The Olympics were broke. The Olympics were broke until the 80s. You know, I had a professor, Michael Payne, the Olympic turnaround, wrote a book about it. I mean, they almost went bust. And until they revamped their commercial strategy, same with Juventus. You know, when I was in Torino with Juventus, it was the same story. 2014.
Premier League in the 90s?
Yeah, no, hey, look, it should be a message for everyone from sports to non-sports. So let's see what we get and let's throw this into the world, Michael. It's been a pleasure. Until the next time.
It has been a pleasure, Alan. Till the next time. Well, I'm sure we'll probably have another hour conversation ourselves outside of this. But everyone, thank you for listening for the officially, technically the second episode of Monetization in Sport. We'll be doing this weekly, so we'll catch up with everyone next week. Thanks for listening.
Right. Thank you. Cheers.